Dear listeners, Happy New Year and welcome to the first edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine for 2024. To ease our contributors back into the swing of things, I chose what I hoped would be a fairly easy topic and asked them to tell us about their hometowns, whatever that means to them. The place where they were born, grew up, live now, or feel a strong connection to. I don't think there are too many great surprises. A few arrived in the area in very roundabout ways, and one has moved on from Sudbury, yet still feels connected enough to keep up his regular contributions to our magazine. Another reason for choosing the topic is that I feel a bit torn between two hometowns. One of them, the place I grew up and went to school, Walthamstow, a village that found itself absorbed by the growth of Victorian London. The other, the place my heart though is reserved for, is the place I came into the world, Pembroke Dock, West Wales. It's not the most picturesque town in Pembrokeshire, but my family left for London a few days before my fourth birthday and returned each summer to visit my now long gone grandparents. I go back still every few years. Our first contributor started out as a Walthamstow girl too, before discovering she was a natural at country life. But I'll let Paula Short tell you all about it.
After 30-odd years in London, where I enjoyed school, work and play, quite a lot of play, come to think of it, you would think a move to rural Essex would have been a step too far. But I took to it like a duck to water. Our house was a mile outside a village, our only neighbours the local farming family, who were very welcoming. On reflection, I think they were only too pleased to see a previously long empty house occupied. Because our children went to school elsewhere, little contact was made with the village, but we were happy to be included in the farming fraternity. Added to which, our London pals were always grateful to enjoy our country retreat. We were never lonely. But after nearly 20 years there, during which time we brought up our children, rode our horses, and became totally immersed in country life, we were ready for a move into a village. The move proved to be a good choice. Sadly, prior to our moving there, the people who bought the only pub decided to turn it into a house. However, the locals, not to be beaten, formed a social committee, and boy, did they know how to be social. There was much to-ing and fro-ing between houses. The smallest event was treated as an excuse for celebration, and no one was excluded unless it really wasn't your bag. During this time, we realised we had become village people. I was even persuaded to become a parish councillor, so for our next move, we chose another village. It couldn't have been more different from the first, but it became apparent all villages have their own personality, something unique to offer. Pretty soon we found our niche, and for the first time in years we were within walking distance of a pub and a village shop. Looking back, both villages have given me something that enriched and expanded my life, apart from lasting friendships. In the first, the WI asked me to give a talk on a planned holiday to Peru, which gave me a late career move as a speaker. In the second, I was invited to lead services at church. Initially, I was way out of my comfort zone, but at my age, who wants to be comfortable? So why am I telling you this? Because despite these moves, there was another one constant in our lives. Living on the Essex-Suffolk borders, Sudbury became our shopping town of choice. We never went to Chelmsford and only occasionally to Colchester, but the little market town suited the people we had become. You would think that after so many years going into Sudbury, I would have become complacent about its charms. But on the contrary, on my weekly visit, I continued to feel a glow of goodwill and appreciation for my surroundings. As you enter from the Essex direction, its narrow streets, its half-timbered houses, its doorways small enough to accommodate the people they were originally built for, continue to fascinate me. I feel so lucky this is on my very doorstep, a place that others choose to visit in order to enjoy a holiday. Amongst other things, one of the draws is Sudbury's most famous son, the artist Thomas Gainsborough, whose original house is now an art centre. His statue is proudly displayed in the market square, just in front of the church, which was recently renovated. I'm sure he would approve of the fact that inside the church, regular craft fairs are held, and more recently a Christmas tree festival, each tree contributed by the many clubs and societies in the town. No longer just a place of worship. The church is living the life it should, as a venue for people to come together socially and in friendship. It has become an accessory to the regular market days where stallholders display their wares, usually accompanied by cheeky banter. Sometimes there's a party atmosphere with the occasional brass band or group of Morris dancers. And with all this magic, it's easy to understand why Sudbury has inspired writers. Dickens is credited with basing Eatanswill, a fictional town mentioned in the Pickwick Papers, on the town. Then there's the author of 101 Dalmatians, who let some of his dogs run wild on its ancient streets. On a personal level, I can offer more. I have happy memories of attending the tiny Key Theatre to see my then primary school daughter taking part yearly in the Sudbury Festival. Then, on a special birthday, we took a boat big enough to accommodate a few friends and family down the River Stour to a pub venue where we shared a celebratory lunch. So, on reflection, I realised we were first drawn to Sudbury because it wasn't a big town with multivarious shops. Its intimacy allows you to get to know people. It's a proud, happy place, and that happiness infects the people who live there. And it has infected me too. As the man famously sang, it's my kind of town.
Thank you, Paula. I can't help thinking the Sudbury Tourist Board should snap you up. But first, the party's at your house. In our next item, Ken Watkins sets the story straight on his hometown before eventually settling in his wife's.
Hometown. Coventry, famous for the motor industry, Lady Godiva, Jimmy Hill and a cathedral bomb during the Second World War, was my hometown. Well, city, actually. I was born and grew up there, and I guess at heart I remain a Coventry kid. But my time in the city came to an end many years ago. The car industry dominated my early years. My dad worked at the Daimler, and several uncles, aunts and cousins worked at other motor manufacturers in the city. And all the cars various family members had were made, not just put together, in the city, but that was then. Lady Godiva was real, but disappointingly, there's no truth in the story she actually rode through the city naked to stop her husband taxing the people. But the legend gave the English language the phrase Peeping Tom, reputedly the only citizen to watch her ride by. Also totally untrue, but the legend is so much more entertaining than the facts. Jimmy Hill made Coventry City Football Club one of the most talked about in the land in the 1960s. And for a few years we enjoyed sky blue heaven. And a new cathedral, consecrated in 1962, rising next to the ruins of the old. No matter how many times I visited the old and the new, I always left with a majestic impression. I left Coventry behind in 1966 when I started work after leaving university. Journalism was the career I wanted to follow, so naturally I applied to my local newspaper, the Coventry Evening Telegraph. It was a paper I'd grown up with, 6 days a week it came through the door, and on Saturday night, the sports edition, the pink, was also delivered. But I didn't get a job there. The paper's policy at the time was to take on a graduate trainee every other year. I just happened to graduate in the wrong year. So the editor kindly contacted his counterpart on another paper in the group, the Cambridge Evening News. I went for an interview, was offered a job, and living at home came to an end. However, I did go back to live with my parents in 1984 for a few weeks, when we were in the process of moving to Banbury, where I'd taken up the post of deputy editor at the Banbury Guardian, until the house sale and purchase had been completed, and my wife and children moved into our new home in Banbury. I enjoyed the luxury of staying with Mum and Dad. I last visited Coventry more than 20 years ago. Coming back to Suffolk from a holiday in the Lake District, we went the long way round, down the M6, to visit my last surviving aunt. Joan, married to my dad's youngest brother Arthur, is now sadly gone, but I have fond memories of that day together. A few years later, we went there again for Joan's 80th birthday. Sadly, by then, she struggled to remember us. So, with no relations left in Coventry, my generation having largely moved away, we haven't been back since. For 35 years, I regarded Sudbury as my hometown, even if I didn't actually live in the town itself. But I worked there for the Suffolk Free Press for almost 24 of those years, firstly as editor, and then returning to the paper as sports editor after a lengthy spell commuting to London. We lived first in Acton and then Alfeton. In the latter, any time we went out, it was almost instinctive to turn left at the bottom of our road in the direction of Sudbury. Visits to Bury St Edmunds meant turning right, and my autopilot certainly let me down on more than one occasion. Fortunately, it meant only a couple of hundred yards in the wrong direction before turning round at the village green. I couldn't have wished for a better area to live and work in. Both villages and organisations in Sudbury were very community-minded. I enjoyed our involvement in the community, which gave us plenty of friends and a store of good memories. But now, Barry is my hometown. It's my wife's, really. Judy grew up there and was living there when we met at university in North Wales. She's followed the Barry tradition of many people from the town who went away for work or other reasons, but eventually came back to where their heart was. And I happily came with her.
Three. Thank you, Ken. I'm always a bit sorry when old tales are debunked, but I suppose it would be too much to think that only one person would have peeped out of the whole town. Our guest this edition is the Mayor of Sudbury, Councillor Jan Osborne. Jan's here to tell us all about not only her hometown, but her adopted town.
Good evening to you all, and wishing you all a very happy and healthy new year. I was born in Lewisham, which was on the boundary of the London area, many, many years ago. I won't say how long, but it was a long time ago. My father died when I was a year old, so I never knew him, but my mother was left with myself to bring up and two young boys, and it was very, very difficult. Times were very, very hard, but I was brought up in a loving and secure family, and when I look back on that, I'm sure that's what gave me the holdings for where I am today. So moving on a little bit from when I was born, I met my husband 54 years ago, Adrian Osborne, who has also been Mayor of Sudbury twice, in fact. We have two daughters, one who lives in Woodbridge and is a teacher, and the other one lives in Bury St Edmunds and she is a mental health nurse, and I have to say I'm extremely proud of both of them. I have two grandchildren, Esme and George. George is 17 and being a typical 17-year-old boy, and Esme is just about to take her GCSEs this year and wishes to become a lawyer. So I am hoping that when she's fully qualified, she'll have enough money to keep her grandmother and grandfather in the lifestyle that they may have become used to. So in 1999, Adrian and I moved to Sudbury. And actually, my grandparents were born and bred in Newton Green. So I sort of came back to my roots, if you like. We loved Sudbury. We would go out from walks and just to get to know the area. And having come from Frinton-on-Sea in Essex, we weren't used to people saying hello to us and talking to us. But when we'd go out for our walks, everybody was so friendly. It was unbelievable. They would talk to you, whoever they were, wherever they were, they would say hello to us. And we fell in love with the area, and we decided we wanted to put something back into the community that we'd grown so fond of. So we both stood for election. My husband was elected into town before myself, and then I followed suit 2 years later. And then we became district councillors. So during my time as a district councillor, I was on the cabinet for housing, which was responsible for all the social housing, antisocial behaviour and homelessness. So as you can imagine, it was a very emotive portfolio to have. Then I became deputy leader at Baber, and that again was very stressful but very, very rewarding. This takes me on to now when I became mayor of Sudbury in May of last year. Wow, what a privilege. I was so taken back to be elected as mayor. I couldn't believe what was happening to me, and I knew that my mother looking down on me would have been extremely proud. It has been a very fantastic time for me, a great privilege. I have met so many wonderful people, visited some wonderful places, and I hope that I have been a really strong ambassador for the people of Sudbury. Sudbury is a wonderful, wonderful place. I've been privileged to attend the Heritage Weekend a few months ago, where there was Dalmatians running all over the place, which was great, having my photo taken with all these dogs, because I absolutely love dogs, so that was fantastic. There was the opening of St. Peter's only a few weeks ago. Again, I cut the ribbon there. It was great. We were inside and they opened up the doors, and there in front of Roger Green and myself were all these people. There must have been about 200-300 people waiting for the opening of their very loved church. And we will continue to call it St. Peter's, because that is what it's known as to all the people that love the building itself. I then was privileged to open up the newly renovated Waitrose. And there again, it was wonderful to see so many people there, so enthusiastic for their new store. It was lovely. And I love shopping round there, and I hope that you will enjoy shopping round there as well. We've got a lovely Gainsborough house, which I know is proving very, very popular with our visitors. I think we get about 30 visitors to the building each day, which is great. So we need a hotel. Wouldn't it be great to have a hotel so that people could visit Gainsborough House, stay there, stay in the town, spend their money, and we get that economy coming back into Sudbury. It is fantastic. It's exciting times for Sudbury. We've just recently had a Waterstones that has opened up, and many little more independent shops coming into Sudbury. Sudbury is going places. It is a wonderful, wonderful town. Yes, it has its challenges to deal with. We know what's coming forward with parking charges, but I know that you people in Sudbury will work hard with myself to make sure that Sudbury continues to be the wonderful and great town that it is. Thank you all very much, and I hope you enjoy visiting the town at some point. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jan, for taking such a great opportunity to tell us about what you've done, what's coming up, and just generally celebrating Sudbury in your family role of Mayor of Sudbury. And now for the quiz. I think it might be just a little bit harder this time, but let's give it a shot. So, question one. Peter O'Toole played which English king in the 1968 film The Lion in Winter? a film about the king, his bickering, scheming family, set around Christmas of 1183. Number two. Which singer performed A Winter's Tale, which reached number two in the UK pop charts in December 1982? Three. Can you name the last Anglo-Saxon king of England? Four. What would you traditionally use a spirtle for? Five. What food differentiates a Welsh from an English full breakfast? Six. From the early 1700s to the 1860s, half of Coventry's population made a living from the manufacture of which product? Seven. In which year did an Icelandic volcano eruption cause massive flight cancellations around Europe? Eight. What drink did a chemist named William Owen invent in his shop in Barras Bridge, Newcastle, in 1927? Nine. Who buried a large wheel of Parmesan cheese in his garden along with his gold and important documents, lest they be burned in the Great Fire of London in 1666? 10. The actor James Hayter played Samuel Pickwick in the 1952 film adaptation of Charles Dickens' novel The Pickwick Papers, but he also narrated TV adverts for the manufacturer of which exceedingly good cakes? I'll be back with the answers later, of course. I'm sorry, I've thrown a few random ones in there, haven't I? Now, though, we have Toby Jacobs to tell us some favourite things about his hometown.
The 30th of July, 1970, was just an ordinary summer's day, except for the fact that one Toby Spencer Jacobs entered the world, courtesy of St Mary's Maternity Hospital, Broad Green, Croydon. So began a 45-year relationship with the town, until relocating to Suffolk in 2015. The London Borough of Croydon is one of the southernmost boroughs of the city, nestled snugly between Bromley and Sutton. It used to be part of Surrey until it was swallowed up by Greater London's ever-expanding conurbation. Sadly, over the years, the town has made it into the media for all the wrong reasons. However, for those people who lived there, this image wasn't always recognisable. After all, there is good and bad everywhere. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about some of the more positive aspects of Croydon, from its famous film director to its modern-day tram system and a notable selection of alumni. All aboard. As filmographies go, this must surely be hard to beat. Lawrence of Arabia, Bridge on the River Kwai, Dr. Zhivago, Ryan's Daughter, and A Passage to India. Not to mention adaptations of the Dickens classics, Oliver Twist, and Great Expectations. The romantic drama Brief Encounter is also attributed to him. We are, of course, referring to Sir David Lean, CBE, one of Britain's most famous film directors and a native of Croydon. Fittingly, the local art house cinema has been named after him. He was born on the 25th of March 1908 at 38 Blenheim Crescent, South Croydon. His parents were Quakers, and subsequently he attended a religious school in Reading. There isn't a great deal of information about his life in the town, other than he left education aged 18 and went to work in his father's accountancy firm. It is claimed that receiving a box brownie camera ignited his creative side, and in 1927 he got himself an apprenticeship at Gaumont Studios. Eventually, Lean became an editor, and after a series of successes, he made his directorial debut in 1942, alongside Noel Coward. A glittering career followed, but after his 1970 film, Ryan's Daughter, was panned by critics, he took a 14-year hiatus, only returning in 1984 with A Passage to India. Until his death in 1991, Lean dabbled in a few minor projects, but his golden years were behind him. He lived in Narrow Street, Limehouse, which has another famous resident from the film world, Sir Ian McKellen. There must be something in the water there. As one steps out of East Croydon Station, you could be forgiven for thinking that you had stepped back in time. Only the modern office blocks betray that thought. For there, in front of the station, are three tram platforms, part of the Tramlink network. However, these aren't your 1940s bone shakers. These are sleek, smooth, and fast. When the system opened in 2000, the carriages were painted red to match the local buses, but they were later repainted a light green colour to highlight the environmental aspect of electric transport. Originally called Croydon Tramlink, it was renamed by TfL to reflect its full extent. Most of the system falls within the borough itself, but it does venture into Beckenham in the east and Wimbledon in the west. One of the best things about taking a tram is that traffic jams are not usually a problem. Although some of the trams do run along regular roads, most of the network has its own dedicated carriageway. When Tramlink was being designed, it was noted that there were a couple of abandoned railways in the town that could be utilised, and a further existing but underused line. This made it easier for the construction process, as the routes were already there, waiting to be brought back to life. There has been talk about extending the system up to Crystal Palace, but so far, that hasn't materialised. Being the only borough in London to have its own tram network has been a positive for Croydon, and it's not the first time that the town has led the way in public transport. South London, in general, has a fine roll call of musicians and entertainers, from David Bowie and Jules Holland to Bob Monkhouse and Nick Haywood. Croydon is no exception. With the recent passing of Shane McGowan from the Pogues, it is a perfect time to remember his duet with Kirsty MacColl on arguably one of the best Christmas songs ever written. Kirsty grew up in the town and had numerous solo hits, as well as other collaborations. She left us far too soon. Another native was Roy Hudd, who had a long and varied career on stage and screen. He became an authority on British music hall and variety. Not to be confused with Croydon-born Roy Budd, a jazz musician and composer who wrote the score for Michael Caine's dark thriller, Get Carter. Saint-Étienne, the Noisettes and Stormzy are some of the more recent successes to hail from the town. One surprising revelation was that survival expert Ray Mears was not brought up by natives in the wilds of Borneo, but grew up in South Croydon, an area that also gave us the comedian Sue Perkins and the 80s supermodel Kate Moss. So there you have it. All is sometimes not as it seems. A town which has suffered at the hands of the media at times has a rich and varied history. Having now lived in Suffolk for nearly 9 years, I really love its landscape and its nature. I listen to the local radio station and support the county football team. So you could say that I am now fully assimilated into East Anglian life. However, there are times when my mind wanders back to a warm summer's night and the sound of the trams rumbling past my flat window, and I feel rather nostalgic for Croydon. After all, it is my hometown.
Thank you, Toby. I stayed in Croydon for a time between house moves once and was impressed with its train connection. Not just London and the South Coast, but Cardiff. And was it Glasgow or Edinburgh too? And don't forget the Fairfield Hall's Croydon. We all heard about those on a Friday evening on Radio 2. Now, local girl Sue Robson remembers past times in Sudbury in a poem read by Ruth Salisbury Higgs.
I was born and bred in Sudbury, a lovely market town. And when I look around me, I sometimes have to frown, as the places I remember where I spent my early life are embedded in my memory as a schoolgirl, mum and wife. The hours spent in the outdoor pool and playing in Bellevue, roller skating in the park and playing tennis too. The fun we had at high school, which is now an empty space. The youth clubs and the cinemas, all gone without a trace. Dolly's sweet shop, Meeson's and the milk jug were a treat. Now all we have are coffee shops where youngsters love to meet. Dances at the town hall and the chip van after dark. There always seems so much to do, they really left their mark. The Bambi and the Bongo, the Juvenian and the Grill. These places were so popular, the memories I have still. The Co-op, Downs Way, Price Right and Baxter's Butchers too. So many of those names have gone, these are just a few. My working years were all in town, so handy to be near. All the places I have loved and hold so very dear. The schools I loved have disappeared and those shops are closed and bare. It's very hard to tell sometimes exactly what was there. But times have changed and we all move on. Things are never quite the same. But I would love to go back to those times and live my youth again.
Thank you, Ruth, for lending your voice to Sue's poem, despite having arrived back from Australia only last night. And thank you, Sue, for sharing your memories. I imagine there'll be more than a few heads nodding along at home. Now, it's not a competition, but do count up your score. Here come the quiz answers. So, number one was Henry II. Number two was David Essex, very popular in my household. Harold II was defeated by William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings in 1066 and all that. Number four is stirring porridge. Number five is lava bread, that processed seaweed delicacy. Number six is actually ribbon. Coventry is known for its ribbon weaving. Number seven is 2010. Number eight is Lucozade. I don't know if, like me, you remember it arriving in yellow cellophane that was very crackly, but, you know, you only had it when you were ill. Number nine is Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist. And number 10, Mr. Kipling. Now, how did you do? There were lots of heads nodding in the studio here. Second furthest from home, pipped by me, I'm afraid, we have Richard Fawcett with a correct emphasis.
Two people. Never met, lived in many places, but not where they were born, came to Sudbury at the same time to work in the same place, but did not at first live here, merely close by. And then things, as is their wont, changed. I was born in Newcastle, with the stress on the second syllable and a short E in the first. Not in Newcastle, stressed on the first syllable with its long E. So, Newcastle upon Tyne, or simply on Tyne, and not Newcastle under Lyme. Heather, born in Malmesbury, reached Sudbury via Twickenham, Bangor, Tübingen and Fleetwood, not exclusively, and lived in all except Malmesbury. So, what is a hometown? Here in Sudbury, do you need ancestors who hobnobbed with Simon of Sudbury? Will you get by remembering the railway tracks lying across Great Eastern Road? Do you need to feel accepted and that you belong? And do you even care? 7 a.m. train out, 9 p.m. train back, away at weekends? For myself, I've long felt warm reassurance on returning, for example, from family in the north and approaching Bury St Edmunds by road or rail, knowing that home is only the A134's length away. Awful though the A134 can be. The sense of belonging here in Sudbury came first with both of us teaching here, in school, and then, after some readjustments, not in school. For a time, Heather worked with school refusers and also for many years taught music from home to pupils of all ages. It's special being remembered by people you've taught wherever it happened. You taught my mum. Yes, German. No, keyboard. Oh, yes, and German. That was at school, though. Belonging comes too from running businesses in town, separately or together, both from home and from bricks and mortar in the high street. In our case, actually a side street. We have entertained with music and drama in town and in a wide area roundabout, again, either separately or together, and we have volunteered, particularly at the Quay, in another side street, and St Peter's. Above all else, we have brought up family here in Sudbury. Side streets have been central, paradoxically. We spent 25 happy years in a Victorian-era terraced house in Side Street Newman's Road. A stone's throw from the bustling town centre, we lived in the calm of surrounding footpaths threading through vestiges of the old orchard running back from Waldingfield Road between large gardens with numerous fruit trees. Our garden rang alongside what we learned had been known as Puddingy Lane, which in 2000-2001 we helped to have restored to the rights of way map after an inquiry established that a barrier which suddenly sprang up had no business being there. Liz Wiles and the Town Council were instrumental in restoring access to Girling Street and the town centre and bypassing at least some of that steep hillside. Another important side street was Station Road, where we opened Two's Live Music Shop in 1985, and where, as near commercial neighbours, we had at various times Gosling's Art Shop, The Florists, a shop selling video, applause costume hire run by Dalek actor or operator John Martin, Blackie the Architect, Brunton Propellers, and the Institute Club. From Dixon's Garage we had several Skodas when it was fashionable to mock Skodas. I recall a drive into town from Boxford, however, one snowy morning in an Estelle which was almost the only vehicle coping with the conditions. We did not actually leave Boxford to come into town to live in Newman's Road until 1989, when the shop was now much busier. In time, however, Station Road became a less suitable location and we closed the shop. Grateful memories remain of Sudbury and Cornard folk who supported us, and many of whom still recall the shop. all aspects of our lives here have been involved with people in the community and with members of their families, and they with ours. Any drawbacks to life in our hometown? Well, walking at least twice daily in our shop days between Newman's and Station Roads across Market Hill in all seasons and weathers told us that the reshaping of Sudbury over time has created, yes, some iconic townscapes. Also, for a supposedly small town, some very long, straight streets that act as wind tunnels, whichever wind might be blowing. And if that's the worst we've had to bear, we haven't done badly.
So there, like Colesroom, Newcastle, give it a little bit more time and Richard must surely be on his way to being a naturalised Sudburyan. To close the doings, though, Margaret King considers the pros and cons of returning to her native village.
Some years ago, I believe Adele wrote a song called Hometown Glory. It's not one of her better known songs, but it is a short eulogy to London, at least the part from where she hails, namely West Norwood. At that early age, she was upset about the thought of leaving the city, having many nostalgic memories for the place which she called home. So it is, I imagine, with many of us. It could be the place where you feel happiest, where you were born, where you have relocated to, where all your family lives, whatever, it becomes your hometown. My hometown, that is, if a village qualifies for that title, has to be Glemsford in Suffolk, and it is the place I know most about, because I was born there in the upper bedroom of a cottage, now part of the White Studio, a beauty fashion salon. I lived there for about 8 years, moving later to a bigger property. The chain was broken when at the age of 18 I went to college in London for 3 years, worked and lived in both Croydon and Colchester for another 3 years before inheriting the family property in Glemsford and getting married. Subsequently, I returned to my hometown where I have been ever since. So what does one say about the place one knows best? Glemsford is a big, sprawling village, advantageously situated on a hilltop, a fact which has escaped no one when we recall the copious amount of rainfall we have recently experienced and witness the dreadful flood photographs from other low-lying districts. Likewise, and fortunate in other ways, because of its being off the beaten track, the village is virtually ignored by the casual tourist as he makes his curious way along the main road, stopping in Clare, Cavendish and Lonmelford, before navigating to the medieval village of Lavenham, the undoubted jewel in the crown of Suffolk's tourist attractions, at least when it comes to medieval best-preserved villages. From the Telegraph to the Guardian, every newspaper will attest this. But Glemsford's elevated situation does afford a number of, often much envied, merits entirely missed by those wandering explorers. One has only to find any of its high vantage points to look down and see the stupendous pastoral views which they offer. Look down into the valleys, watch the River Glem as it meanders through the floodplains. Observe the endless fields of arable farming, their colours changing as the seasons come and go. See also the many woods which surround the village, their names synonymous with centuries long past, Scotchford, Lumpet, Easty and Court. And nestled amongst them a number of flint church towers peaking above the horizon. To fully appreciate some of these amazing country views, Glemsford has fairly recently become custodians of an officially designated quiet road. known locally as the Loop or the Horseshoe. Way back when I was a child, we just called this popular walk as going around Plum Street. It is about a 2 mile long circuit, and besides the views, it also passes some lovely, quite isolated cottages and houses. Nowadays, it's used frequently by young mums with prams, pushchairs, dog walkers, couples, runners, and family groups. To return to the village itself, Glemsford has always had an industrial history. Back in the past, it housed a large number of factories which employed the local populace. To mention just a few, there was the silk mill, the horsehair and flax factories, the foundry, and later the plastic factory. In addition, during the late Georgian and Victorian times, there were a host of thriving cottage industries, such as mat making, mostly operating from the owner's backyards. To travel even further back in time, the wool industry flourished here. You have only to look at parts of the large parish church of St Mary's to see evidence of former wealth, an internal example being the Golding Chapel, built from the money of John Golding, a rich wool merchant. Glemsford now bears little resemblance to the 1841 map which I have in my possession. In those days, I imagine that the inhabitants of the Skates Hill, Egremont Street, lower part of the village were almost regarded as foreigners by those living in the Brook Street, Chequers Lane area, or even further afield in the Bells Lane Churchgate vicinity of the parish church. I guess in those days it was a collection of small hamlets. It still has clusters of older houses around the four greens. Yes, four, not just the conventional one. During the last 80 years or so, large estates, both council and private, have been built, sitting on much of the former arable land and meadows where once cattle grazed. The current neighbourhood plan proposes another large estate adjoining an existing one. As a consequence, Glemsford now houses a very large community, an eclectic mix of young and old, which adds to its present vibrancy. Glemsford boasts active churches, a plethora of societies and interest groups, all flourishing, not to mention a large, well-subscribed school, a surgery, a pharmacy, two supermarkets, a social club, a variety of hairdressers, a fish and chip shop, a Chinese takeaway, a brilliant library, and an excellently run public house called The Angel. This list is by no means entirely comprehensive. There are bound to be omissions. There are drawbacks, of course. It has never been an elitist village, let alone a dead one full of second homes. And yes, as in any large community, petty vandalism, the occasional drug-related problem, and teenage misbehaviours are destined to feature very promptly on social media. However, as far as I can gather from general conversation and positive vibes, the majority of inhabitants are very happy. People are very friendly and always acknowledge each other when passing in the street. Many help out in times of trouble. Others have returned to live in the village after working away for a while. Over the last 20 years or so, there has been an influx of recently retired or semi-retired couples who have become very much involved in local community activities. They have joined and ran many of the social groups, bringing in new blood and ideas, whilst promoting increased membership. The majority of these relatively new inhabitants appear to be well and truly settled in Glemsford, none, to the best of my knowledge, formulating plans to be moving away any time soon. In conclusion, I think that everyone's hometown is the place they know best, the one of which they are the most familiar, and arguably the one where they feel the happiest. It is, of course, as easy to romanticise a place as to condemn it. I have tried to be open-minded when telling you about my hometown. Does it qualify for Adele's iconic title of Hometown Glory? Yes, I think it does.
Thank you, Margaret, for that guided tour of Glemsford. It sounds like you've landed in just the right place where you started. And that brings an end to today's edition of the magazine. Thank you very much for listening, and best wishes for the year ahead from all of us. Good night.